This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, Yandra, Maori, Nisambule Vinaka. Welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka here with you this morning. And coming up on today's show, Papua New Guinea declares a polio outbreak.
So they detected the virus in the sewage samples, and they detected it in Leh, and then they also detected it in Port Moresby.
Vanuatu's president revokes an order to reduce the prison sentences of 70 inmates after a public outcry.
For the president's office, whether him or his advisors, not to consult correctionals, not to connect with the parole board, is unbelievable.
And in Timor-Leste, there's outrage as a former priest convicted of child sex abuse could be up for pardon.
He should just be in jail, die in jail, serve his sentence for the crimes that he committed, and we should be thinking about the victims.
We'll have more on those stories coming up. I'm Evan Wasuka. This is Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We start in Timor-Leste, where legal aid groups are calling for the country's president to reject a proposal to pardon an American former priest who's been convicted of abusing young children. Richard Daskback is expected to be pardoned next week, just 4 years into a 12-year sentence, with one of his victims fearing for his safety. The case has put the spotlight on the relationship between the convicted pedophile and Timor's leaders. Maria, who has been given a pseudonym by the ABC, was a child when she was abused by Catholic priest Richard Daskback. She was relieved when he was sentenced to 12 years in jail in 2021 for abusing her and dozens of others in a rural orphanage. But the thought of the American getting a pardon next week terrifies Maria.
I don't want him to get out of prison, because if he gets out, he could commit his evil deeds to other women. He could go back to the Topohonis orphanage and could hurt our hearts as victims who have attended the trial in court. Before he went to prison, we were afraid. We looked for people to hide us. When he went to prison, we felt free. We were not afraid.
Richard Daskback arrived in the former Portuguese colony in 1966 as a missionary and helped in the independence movement. Many of his allies are now in leadership positions, including former freedom fighter and now Prime Minister Xanana Gusmão and President José Ramos Horta. It's not clear what role the men had in proposing the pardon, but Mr. Gusmão was photographed at Daskback's 84th birthday party. Sarah Niner, a researcher at Monash University, says the proposal sends the wrong message at a time when society was starting to talk about sexual abuse.
These things have been hidden and covered up as they were here for decades, and Timorese society is just starting to break out and speak about these issues.
Ms. Niner says the proposal for a pardon draws attention away from the victims and rewards the perpetrator.
He should just be in jail, die in jail, serve his sentence for the crimes that he committed, and we should be thinking about the victims.
Judico Social, a legal aid group representing 15 survivors of sexual abuse committed by Daskback, is calling on the president to first meet the victims before deciding on a pardon. It's a position Maria agrees with.
I want to meet and tell President Ramos Horta that is not a small case, but a serious case. That is why I want to meet the president to speak directly to him, because we did not lie about it. If the president wants to make a decision to release him from prison, then the president wants to make us suffer.
That's child abuse survivor in Timor, Maria, speaking there. And that story was produced by the ABC's Timor reporter, Vonia Vieira. We stay in Timor because there's controversy over that proposed pardon for former priest and pedophile Richard Daskback. It's become a political firestorm. And among those raising concern over this move by government is the opposition MP, Nurima Alkatari. She spoke to the ABC's Doug Dingwall about the government's plan, which she says shows a clear lack of empathy for the victims of Richard Daskback.
I'm very concerned, especially for the victims and for the trauma that they have been through, and that by hearing this, they might they most probably are living their traumas all over again. This was a very serious crime, and it was not easy for the victims or survivors to come forward and report it. And I think with this suggestion from the government is disregarding completely the victims' feelings and the victims' suffering.
What message does this proposal send to the victims of Das Back's sexual abuse?
Well, I believe that with this, it will be a regression in our nation, in our society, in regards to violence against children and sexual abuse against children and against women in general. Because the impact that this might have is that victims will stop coming forward. It's already so hard for them to come forward and to report. And with this, they will feel like there's no point in coming forward, because if the perpetrator has a connection with someone in power.
Have you received any information about why the Timor-Leste government is proposing to pardon him?
No, I haven't. But to be very honest, I'm not surprised that this happened. Since the pardon law was amended by the majority in parliament that is in government, that is from the parties in government, that I was already sort of expecting this to happen.
What do you believe should happen from this point?
I'm really hoping that the president will have the courage to stand by what he personally has said before, that he would never pardon people that have been sentenced for abuse, for sexual abuse.
That's Nerima Alkatari. She's an opposition MP in Timor-Leste, and she was speaking there to the ABC's Doug Dingwall.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Politalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Politalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka and you're listening to Pacific Beat. It's a well-known fact that the Pacific region has some of the highest rates of domestic and gender-based violence in the world. In some countries, studies show that 2 out of 3 women are victims of abuse. But the problem isn't just limited to women in disadvantaged communities. Women leaders and politicians aren't immune, with one prominent leader the subject of cyberbullying and harassment. And as Alice Lola here reports, there's calls for change.
On Christmas Eve 2024, Fijian politician Linda Tambuya found out that an explicit video of her was being shared online without her knowledge or consent.
If women are targeted 10 times more online than men, we continue to perpetuate the patriarchy and the discrimination online which existed offline.
Ms. Tambuya was dismissed from her cabinet position after the incident and faced a wave of cyberbullying and harassment.
I was just dismissed, and very, very abruptly, without much explanation. So, you know, it was like I felt I was being punished twice.
The Fijian government has not responded to questions about her dismissal, and the police are investigating how the video came to be online. But Shamima Ali, the coordinator of Fiji's Women's Crisis Centre, says Linda Tambuya's experience speaks to a broader issue in Fijian and Pacific society.
These are systems that are male-dominated, and that is the reason why when violence against women happens, people do not treat it as a crime, that it is a very serious crime. People get murdered within this.
In Fiji, domestic violence is widespread. Studies have shown around 2/3 of women in intimate relationships have been physically assaulted by their partners. Clara left her husband in 2019. But before that, she says she endured years of brutal violence that left her hospitalized.
I was swallowing blood. I got my tooth actually fall. I got bruises on my body too, my face, black eye.
In PNG, UN Women estimates more than 1.5 million women will face gender-based violence every year, like Lorena, a victim of abuse from her estranged husband that left her with broken bones.
In the settlement, I think like out of every 100 women, 99 of them goes to violence. But they don't open up, they don't talk about it. I don't know, they're taking it as a normal thing or something.
In recent decades, laws in more than a dozen Pacific countries have enshrined greater protections for women and harsher punishment for abusers. But changes to the law mean little if police and courts don't enforce them. Constable Leah Ardi is a police officer in the Solomon Islands.
Some of our male colleagues have that cultural barrier that is embedded in them, where women are wrong. Women should respect their husbands by not provoking them.
University of Canterbury Associate Professor Yvonne Crichton-Hill says domestic violence in the Pacific comes from socio-economic issues like poverty, unemployment, as well as cultural norms that promote men's superiority over women.
Even a lack of skills and relationships. So, for example, not being able to manage conflict in a healthy way, or maybe individuals and families have had experiences of family violence themselves.
She says women need to lead responses to gender-based violence.
Views about women that actually hold up women and empower women and see the value of women.
Back in Fiji, the Women's Crisis Centre is doing just that, visiting villages and holding workshops addressing domestic violence. La, a victim of domestic violence herself, says that having open conversations that respect village culture has led to progress.
It is very important for us. It is important in the sense that we change the mindset of the men.
Across the Pacific, it's women like La leading from within communities and making the steps towards recalibrating a social norm.
And that was the ABC's Alice Lola here with that report. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And the World Health Organization has declared a polio outbreak in Papua New Guinea after two children were diagnosed with the disease. It's the first such outbreak in the country since 2018, when polio was last detected and then eradicated. Community transmission of the virus was confirmed in the city of Lae, where a screening program detected the virus in stool samples from two healthy children. PNG's Health Minister, Elias Kapavore, says the government is moving into action with the support of donors.
There will be a mass immunization coverage covering over 3.5 million children. I estimate will be covered through a polio vaccine coverage that is already happening in many of our provinces.
Vera Mendonza is the UNICEF representative in Papua New Guinea, and she sat down with the ABC's PNG correspondent, Marion Farr, to explain how the polio virus was detected.
So the way the polio virus and the outbreak actually got detected is through the sewage samples. So they detected the virus in the sewage samples, and they detected it in Lae. And then they also detected it in Port Moresby. And they also detected it in the stool samples of two healthy children. They took samples of many children. And with that detection, then this is now being certified by the government and called as an outbreak.
Is that according to the PNG government's guidelines or the WHO or UNICEF? I mean, what constitutes an outbreak?
So what constitutes an outbreak primarily is if you find it as a circulating virus. If it's only in the sewage samples and it's not in a stool sample, means it's not circulating. But if it is in a stool sample, means it's circulating in the community. So when there's community transmission, then it's designated as an outbreak. So that is a standard definition.
How concerning is it that this outbreak has been declared?
Papua New Guinea has made many strides. The government is really working hard in terms of improving vaccine coverage. This is the first year that the government has actually invested around 18.5 or 19 million kina to ensure that there's no vaccine shortage. So they're actually procuring vaccines through the partners so that every child has access to vaccines. The government has also, with partners, made sure there's cold chain coverage. So the vaccines are stored properly. That's 96% plus. So that's huge. With all that, our immunization rates are very low. We're only 47%. So that is unacceptable. That means we have 53% of the children who are not fully immunized, who can easily be susceptible to vaccine-preventable diseases.
How quickly could this virus circulate in PNG?
In terms of efficiency of the virus, I cannot give you specifics, but I know that we're doing IPV vaccination right now, and we will initiate the OPV, the oral polio vaccine, vaccination in July. So with those rounds, we know by November, we will get our children more than 90% immunized.
What is the risk for neighboring countries?
If a neighboring country has vaccination coverage that's very high, the risk will be very low. If the neighboring country has vaccination coverage that's very low, as any other disease, it will also increase susceptibility for them, right, to the vaccine, to the disease. So it's important for every country in this to have greater than 90% of vaccination coverage for their children. So I think that's the most important message that we need to convey. Rather than worrying about who is coming, what is coming, is to make sure our children in country are fully immunized. All children are fully immunized. And that's what we are doing for Papua New Guinea, to make sure every child is fully immunized.
Do you think it's an achievable goal to have every child immunized by November?
Very feasible. As I told you, in Pomio district, which is a remote district in East New Britain, 82.3% coverage. They can do it. So can every other district do it. What it needs is political commitment, leadership. The government is ensuring vaccines are in country. Partners are supporting. We are now working with the Global Polio Eradication Initiative to make sure we get vaccines in country. UNICEF, WHO partners will make sure the government has vaccines. And then through churches, through leaders, everyone, we can make sure that people bring their children for vaccinations. Those who are very hard to reach will get vaccination. So for me, it's a very easily achievable goal. So something we can celebrate on Children's Day in November.
And that's Vera Mendanza. She's the UNICEF representative in Papua New Guinea. And she was speaking there about a polio outbreak, which was declared yesterday. And she was talking to the ABC's reporter in Papua New Guinea, Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat.
Yes, this is Pacific Beat on a Friday morning. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company. And coming up on the show later this morning, we're going to take a look at the public reaction to a plan by Vanuatu's government to reduce the prison sentences of 70 inmates. Now, this plan has angered a lot of people, particularly those who are victims of crime, like Peter Walker.
For the president's office, whether him or his advisors, not to consult correctionals, not to connect with the parole board, is unbelievable.
We'll hear more about that and why the Vanuatu president has revoked that plan.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The victim of a horrific bashing in Vanuatu says he was shocked, confused, and re-traumatized by the Vanuatu president's decision to reduce his attacker's sentence. The men who brutally assaulted Peter Walker 6 years ago were among the 70 prisoners whose custodial sentences were to be reduced to community service. But following the public outcry, Prime Minister Jotham Nupert announced that President Nike Vurubarovu will revoke that order. In a statement, Mr. Nupert says the president was not given accurate information about several of the detainees, and there'll be an investigation into why that happened. He also apologized for the distress and concern the situation has caused and says all prisoners will remain in custody. There's relief to Mr. Walker, but as he tells our Vanuatu reporter Lily Rose Wellwell, it still doesn't explain how the decision was made and why victims weren't notified. And a warning, this interview contains some confronting material.
It also brings back so many memories. I mean, those memories never leave you, I have to say that. But, you know, I couldn't stop thinking. My cousin had got in touch to say she found it shocking. She lives in New Zealand. This happened 6 years ago at a place in the bush where I'd gone to show them. She was raped by two attackers. There were four. Two were underage. Her husband and myself were also very badly beaten and I had a broken jaw. When he got back to Australia, he had 40 stitches across his head. So it was a very shocking crime that, due to the fact that I'm director of quite a well-known NGO here, it got a lot of attention at the time and people were quite shocked. So to hear that they could just release them without even informing us, you know, just the casual nature of it, that there's no evidence that victims were consulted at all before this decision was made. And when you consider that there are cases of incest, rape, murder, which have happened in the last 6 to 8 months, and, you know, now the victim, thinking that their attacker was going to be at least kept inside for a number of years, suddenly finds that they're back out, in some cases possibly having to come back to that yard where it's a family member. So this is at the time, I'm saying, before I know now that the kind of uproar about it has made them think again. We're still waiting for confirmation of exactly what's happening, but the Prime Minister has assured everybody that it will be reversed, this decision. But that's still we need to see that, and it needs to be very publicly confirmed that that's happened until I myself speak. I can't speak for other victims, but till I start to feel safe again.
Do you think they should have gone about it like in a different way, in a better way, or there should have been a better approach on how to address this?
Yes. Well, the fact that the parole board was completely ignored. I mean, I can understand that there is a problem, that conditions are in the prison are, you know, by UN standards of prisons are just not acceptable. But there has to be another way than just automatically releasing serious criminals. And who is it? Who has been rehabilitated in any way? I mean, the parole board or the correctional staff, when asking how I felt about the parole of one of my attackers that was likely to happen quite soon, they assured me that he'd been through many courses. They felt he would be safer. Of course, you're always going to be worried, but at least there was an approach and to me beforehand. And for the president's office, whether him or his advisors, not to consult correctionals, not to connect with the parole board, is unbelievable. Who are they to suddenly decide that somebody who has raped and then killed a woman, many other cases of incest, murder, rape, for the president's office to decide, oh, we know whether this person is fit for release without actually consulting any of the agencies that deal with these matters. It's unbelievable.
That's a victim of crime, Peter Walker in Vanuatu, there speaking to the ABC's Lily Rose Well in Port Vila. And as he heard there, he was reacting to the Vanuatu president's decision to backtrack on an order to reduce prison sentences for around 70 inmates. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We now go to Tonga, where King Tupou VI has urged leaders to uphold the truth and justice as Parliament wound up its business. The ABC's reporter in Nuku'alofa, Marion Kupu, attended Parliament yesterday and filed this report.
A very cloudy day hung over Nuku'alofa as Tonga's Legislative Assembly held its official closing ceremony this morning. The proceedings commenced at 10:30 a.m., marking the formal conclusion of the parliamentarian session. The ceremony was brief and solemn, consisting solely of the reading of His Majesty's closing speech. While some members of Parliament were notably absent, those in attendance were joined by their spouses and members of the media. The atmosphere inside the chamber was quiet and respectful, in keeping with the occasion's formal tone. I was present to observe and report on the event as part of the local media. Here's a bit of King Dubowo's sixth key message to parliamentarians that was read out by one of the nobles, Lord Maafu.
In his address, the king said, "Leaders must uphold the truth, uphold justice, and fulfill their duties, not for themselves, but for the people and the kingdom."
Alipate Tuivanua Vovaia is a prominent Tongan noble and politician. He is the noble's representative for Tongatapu, and he told me that the Bible was a key part of the king's speech.
He took out three verses from the commandments, 10 commandments, and emphasised that as part of the policies and part of Tonga's constitution, and that's the underlay for the ethics for governments, incoming governments, and for the future.
Lord Whatawhehi Kinkinlau Lolomana Ia Whakawhanua is the Speaker of the Legislative Assembly and is in charge of the House. Today's closing was a chance for Lord Whakawhanua to reflect on the past session.
I think the most significant achievement would be the Parliament managing to complete the legislative schedule that was submitted by Parliament, by the government.
Lord Whakawhanua highlighted two major bills passed in youth justice and cybercrime.
Giving them the opportunity to divert themselves from the official judiciary so that they don't have permanent criminal records. My own personal amendment that added to that bill was the addition of an inclusion of artificial intelligence, especially generative AI, and its potential to cause a lot of damage, especially for women and girls who can be affected by cyberbullying.
Former Prime Minister Huakava Meiliku Sausisovaleni said one part of the King's message struck him deeply.
Government need to actually be accountable to the Parliament. That was re-emphasized, and that's important, whether it's the previous government, this government, or whatever government, they have to understand that they actually have to report or accountable to Parliament itself.
For Deputy Prime Minister Daniela Fusimalohi said, accountability remains critical.
Why are we here in Parliament? We are here to be accountable to the public. And if that was carried out in the last 3 years, probably there would be less concern from the public about certain actions by government.
Parliament reopens next week. The King's challenge to leaders is clear.
And that was the ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupu, with that report. As Pacific countries prepare for next month's United Nations Ocean Summit in France, Vanuatu is leading the charge, calling for greater action to protect the world's oceans. And Vanuatu's government says the outcome of the talks will be a testing ground for an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice. The ABC's Jordan Fennell with more.
It's in Nice, France, where Pacific leaders will join global governments to decide the future of the ocean. The UN Oceans Conference will see the 169 parties to the laws of the seas gathering to discuss ocean pollution, sea level rise, and overfishing. For Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Rekinvanu, what's even more important than the meeting's outcome are what actions will be taken. That's because the Tribunal of the Law of the Seas passed a legal advisory opinion last year, saying pollution management, including of greenhouse gases, is the obligation of members of the Law of the Seas.
This Oceans Conference comes at a really critical time for the world, and it's coming right at the, we anticipate, just before we're seeing the AO come out. And this will be a place where we're seeing all these climate vulnerable states, the SIDS like Vanuatu is a small island developing state, we are all going to be there and we're advocating for the highest ambition.
That advisory opinion sets the stage for another bigger one, which the International Court of Justice will deliver after the end of June. The ICJ advisory opinion looks at what obligations states have to protect their citizens from climate change. Getting it to the world's highest court has been a six-year campaign, starting with university students and then taken on by Vanuatu's government. Vanuatu's legal counsel, Margaretha Webarinka Singh, says the fragmented nature of international law means the advisory, although non-binding, is the Pacific's best shot at getting a legal decision on climate change.
This feature of the ICJ, that it is not only the world's highest court, but also the only court really in the world that has general jurisdiction, is really critical. One could say that one reason why international law has not been sufficiently effective when it comes to addressing climate change and related injustices is that the obligations weren't clear, and it's in part because international law is fragmented.
The ICJ advisory opinion is scheduled for the European summer, so sometime between June and November. Its delivery will come at a tumultuous time internationally as new US President Donald Trump withdraws his country from the Paris Agreement. He's also shied away from international law, signing an executive order that will see companies applying to US regulators for permission to carry out deep sea mining in international waters.
The advisory opinion becomes much more important in this context and serves a critical function because it'll clarify, as we've been saying, the existing obligations of states and obligations under treaties such as the UN Charter, human rights law, which the US is part of. So, yes, in a context in which we're seeing a weakening of multilateralism in many contexts, the strengthening of international law through these advisory opinions, I think, is the counter to that.
Closer to home and away from the ICJ, Ralph Raghavanu says Pacific governments are backing Australia's bid to host UN climate talks. Australia is bidding against Turkey to host the major event in 2026 in the South Australian city of Adelaide. Mr. Raghavanu says the support Australia is getting from the Pacific comes with certain expectations.
We have continued to make it very clear to Australia that we expect them to stop approving any new oil and gas projects. And I think the president of the Pacific Islands Super Island Developing States, who is now the president of Palau, made a very clear statement at the beginning of last month when he was in Sydney, saying that the Pacific Islands expects, in terms of hosting COP31, and it's being touted as a joint hosting, we would expect equal say in what happens at the COP and what the outcomes will be.
That's Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Raghavanu, ending that report from Jordan Fennell.
It's been more than 200 years since missionaries brought Christianity to the Pacific. But since then, the region has grown into a rich blend of diverse faiths, beliefs, and philosophies. Pacific Soul delves into these topics and asks the question, what do we truly believe? Join your host, Melissa Makin, for an insightful talanoa on faith, belief, and spirituality on Pacific Soul. Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And the players from Papua New Guinea's leading women's soccer team, Hikari United, will be on a mission this weekend when they play Auckland United in the OFC Women's Championships League final in Tahiti. And they'll be hoping that third-time lucky works for them after finishing runners-up in the previous two tournaments and after losing their previous two encounters against Auckland by a single goal. In last year's final, the New Zealand team won 1-0, and in the group stage this year, they again did better than the PNG outfit, this time winning by 2-1. There's no doubt that the two best teams have made the decider, with the other five-way off the pace, losing games by big margins. But can Hikari find a way to topple the Kiwis? Matt Manu Kuo from OFC media team says Auckland are wary of their opponents and the Kauri are in with a big chance.
Yeah, I think they do have a very real chance. I think Auckland will go in with that mental edge knowing that they have beaten Ahead Kauri twice. But I spoke to Ben Bates, the head coach of Auckland United, after the semi-final win against the Henderson Eels. And he was saying that there were some things about Ahead Kauri that really rattled them, one of which was their physicality and their pace as well. So it'll be something that the Auckland United girls will really need to focus on. But I think Ahead Kauri, they definitely got a chip on their shoulder walking into this one. But I believe that they will pull off something great in this match.
Clearly what Ahead Kauri don't want, and let's face it, who would, is to be runners-up for the third time in a row. They were runners-up against Auckland United last year and then a slightly different format the year before, but they finished runners-up to AS Feminine from New Caledonia. So they'll be desperate to win it, won't they?
Yeah, they will be desperate. And some of those players were part of both of those campaigns, and especially the coach, Erickson Kamingde, hold on to that experience and knowing that they've got another chance ahead of them. I spoke to some of their players after their semi-final win and they were really insistent on wanting to get the job done finally. So yeah, I think that they've got some key players and some strong players in their team that can really help pull it off. Marie Kaipu, their captain, who has led them for the past two campaigns, she has been a strike weapon for Ahead Kauri United throughout this tournament. She is one goal behind Auckland United's Zoe Benson for the most goals scored at this tournament. So she will definitely be one of the three going into this game. But, you know, speaking to her and also Erickson Kamingde, they seem really determined to finally get it done.
This competition is still quite new, still developing as a competition for women's teams in Oceania. But do you think there'd be some slight concern in the corridors of power that there is a very, very obvious gap between these two teams and the rest?
The more opportunities, I guess, our teams are able to play against the likes of New Zealand, in my eyes, the more opportunities they get to develop their skills and to know the benchmark, I guess, and to know the levels that they need to get up. As we've seen throughout this tournament, there's no hiding away from it. There was a lot of lopsided scores, but these tournaments are good opportunities for teams to grow and to learn. But yeah, I think it'll be definitely one of the things that we need to review moving forward.
And am I right that this time there's more than just being champions of Oceania at stake? Whoever wins gets to compete on the world stage too?
Yeah, the inaugural FIFA World Club Challenge for the women's team. So yeah, it's going to be an exciting one to see who goes through with this one, because that is a huge opportunity for our Oceania teams and, you know, for our little corner of the world to test their skills, I guess, on the big stage. You know, even for some of these teams and some of these players, it's their first time playing internationally as well at this tournament. So if they're able to get that experience and to go overseas for this inaugural competition, then it'll be a great experience for our Oceania teams, but also a great development opportunity as well.
Undoubtedly great for Oceania, whichever team wins and goes on to compete in that tournament. But how amazing would it be if that team was from Papua New Guinea?
Oh, it'll be really amazing. You know, we speak about it with some of the people in attendance to the tournament, some of the people, you know, from Tahiti and also overseas. You see the passion that these Papua New Guineans have for their teams and their athletes and their supporters. We spent some time with them as well, getting to know a bit about their culture and what makes them tick. And I think that if they are able to cross the line in the final against Auckland United and then eventually go to this World Club competition, then I think it'll do leaps and bounds, not only for the country of Papua New Guinea and this club of Ahead Kauri United, but also for our federation as well at OFC, you know, just to show that our teams are getting better, our talent are getting better, and we can show what makes our little corner of the world special.
And that was Matt Manuko from the OFC media team. And the only fly in the ointment is that FIFA have now put back the launch of the Women's World Cup from 2026 to 2028. So whether it would be the winners of this weekend's OFC Championship League final that would go is a matter still to be decided. And that was Matt Manuko from the OFC media team on the line from Tahiti. And you were speaking there to the ABC's Richard Ewitt.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground, having conversations, and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka, taking you through the show this Friday morning. And we've come to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our top stories. And Papua New Guinea has declared a polio outbreak after the disease was detected in public screening. This is the UNICEF's representative in Papua New Guinea, Vera Mendanza.
So they detected the virus in the sewage samples, and they detected it in Leh, and then they also detected it in Port Moresby.
And Papua New Guinea is undertaking a major vaccination drive across, covering 3.5 million children. Also on the show, Vanuatu's president has revoked an order to reduce the prison sentences of 70 inmates after a public outcry. Among those voicing their concerns is Peter Walker, who was attacked some 6 years ago, and his attackers were among those slotted for lower sentences.
For the president's office, whether him or his advisors, not to consult correctionals, not to connect with the parole board, is unbelievable.
And also on the program today, we heard from Timor-Leste, where there is outrage as a former priest and convicted child sex abuser could be up for a pardon. This is Sarah Naina, a researcher into Timor-Leste.
He should just be in jail, die in jail, serve his sentence for the crimes that he committed. We should be thinking about the victims.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat on this Friday morning. I'm Evan Wasuka. We'll be right back with you on your Monday morning with Agnes Tupou.